Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Lisa Hajar. I'm a professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara.
and Prof. Lisa. It's a long time since I've seen you, but you look as wonderful as ever, and I'm excited to have this conversation. So, first query is about what is going on at the moment that is dynamizing, retarding, fascinating, interesting you, concerning you, preoccupying you.
Well, I think that the all-consuming thing for me and a lot of people I know is the war in Gaza. Because I'm already like I'm an expert on Israel and Palestine and have written, on this topic over many years. It's been something that I've been following and writing about in the current period. But one thing that's been really exciting is there was already a group of faculty at UCSB working on issues of Palestine since last year. But after the war started on October 7th, we sort of came together, and it's now this incredible group of like 30 faculty who meet every single week, doing sort of solidarity and actions and teach-ins and so on. So that's been a big all-consuming thing. And I was really lucky that this year, I'm the chair of a department, so that's another thing that sort of preoccupies me. But I was teaching two courses this quarter. One of them, sociology of human rights, and the other is a new course that is in my area of interest called global carceral states. So I was actually able to teach about sort of Palestine and Israel and events in Gaza, as part of my curriculum in both of those classes.
That is an unusual treasure, but of course, it arises in part from something that has been a huge issue for, well, let's say a century, let's say the Balfour Declaration, but longer, but with incredible intensity since 48 and 67, I guess. I wonder if you could, A, correct my version of history, but B, tell us how you're seeing the current conjuncture.
Well, I mean, I think that you're absolutely correct that, there's this conflict has been, sort of ongoing for about 100 years, but especially, for the 75 years since the first, the Palestinian Nakba, when, the war that created Israel and caused the mass displacement of Palestinians. But really, I think things have, been much more intense since 1967, and really, especially in this century, since 2000, in the West Bank and Gaza more, much more so even. And that's not to say that there's not a lot of, repression and suffering in the West Bank. But the situation in Gaza now, which is in a sense, what's happening now is Israel's fifth war on Gaza this century. But this war is unprecedented. I mean, the sort of the scope, intensity, and scale of bombing is unmatched anywhere in the world since World War II. So just, when people see the pictures of just like the complete, gutted every aspect, every corner of Gaza and the massive death toll, one can think about the fact that this is one of the strongest militaries in the world waging unidirectional war on, an occupied population, the half of whom are children, and there's no countering army. So it's really just a one-way onslaught. And so just the unprecedented nature of it has been, both absolutely wrenching and infuriating. But it's one thing I would say that for me, because I do a lot of work on international law, is, seeing how international law is being operationalized in new ways in an effort to sort of, bring about an end or, end to the violence that's going on or hold Israel accountable. And so, I mean, the most obvious example was South Africa taking Israel to the International Court of Justice in order and, charging genocide, and the fact that the ICJ did find plausible genocide going on. And then just seeing like internationally that the governments, mostly from the global South, not, from the West, have been lining up sort of in support of the South African case. So that's one thing that's very interesting, just to sort of see that international law continues to be sort of grabbed at as a source of critique and efforts to sort of save human life, save Palestinian civilians. So I think that that's been something really powerful to see, as is sort of the global demonstrations in sort of demanding ceasefire and calling for let Gaza live is something I mean that too is really unprecedented. Like the duration and the size of people willing to demonstrate for Gaza and the fact that it then is having absolutely no effect on the ground, not least because the Biden administration is arming Gaza while bombing them with airdrop food pallets and things. So it's just it's kind of a geopolitical, like it's geopolitical hypocrisy at its finest. But as a teacher, as somebody who teaches on these topics, it's an incredibly, the tragedy is also an incredible like teachable issue for students. So I felt really gratified to have the opportunity to be teaching these things this quarter.
And Prof. Lisa, getting back to campus, as you just did, it's interesting that cancel culture, so-called, was given a lot of attention until October the 7th, since when the people who were bitching about campus culture, cancel culture, suddenly want to cancel discussion of Gaza. I'm wondering what the climate is like in the University of California in general and on your campus, in terms of feeling able to engage with these issues, given that they get to a very essence of being for many Arab descended people, Arabic folks, Palestinian folks, and some Jewish folks, Ashkenazi, Sephardim, etc.
Well, I would say, it really varies by, I mean, there's a lot of horrible things happening. I mean, Palestine Legal is about to sue Columbia University. So there are different universities have had different sort of track records on what's been going on. One thing that has been consistent is a lot of activism, like in support of, Palestinians and in opposition to the, ongoing war, calling for ceasefire, et cetera. On our campus, there's been, students even just as recently as this past week were doxxed, because of some, sort of skirmishing around posters on our multicultural center. So there are very well-funded organizations that are sort of hunting for people to, shame online, on social media or whatever, or to do things, because they're critical of Israel or they're speaking out on behalf of Palestinians. But the one thing I think that's been really lucky, and I don't take any credit for this on our campus, is some of my colleagues who are active in Academics for Justice in Palestine have just made it, like a monthly or even maybe biweekly recurring thing to go and speak to the top administrators to basically explain to them what the issues are, how students need to be protected, the significance of free speech. And so in that regard, with a few exceptions, I think our university has functioned pretty well, in comparison to other ones. And there's just a very robust student activism, which really, I mean, I got to give it to, like not only Students for Justice in Palestine, but also Jewish Voice for Peace. I mean, there's a lot of Jewish students who are like in solidarity with, the cause of Palestinian, liberation, I would say. So it's something that's, kind of, there's so many contradictions. There's so many, fraught battle lines, but I would say like both sides are well stocked with, a lot of energy. So.
And getting back to October the 7th, I'm still trying to work out what Hamas's strategy was, what the idea was. I've got some mad theories, but I'd love to know your take on it as an expert.
Well, I mean, I would say one thing is like my particular expertise tends to, I mean, I'm an expert on Israel, actually, but I mean, sort of as a knowledgeable person who looks at these things, so I wouldn't ever, pretend to be an expert on Hamas. But my understanding of what happened, like sort of what was going on before the actual atrocities started occurring, was that Hamas and Islamic Jihad had the plan to, there were two sort of factors motivating them. One was to just disrupt what was proceeding to be like the complete normalization between Israel and other, Arab governments, in which case Palestinians were just going to fall further off the agenda of things and just be left, and in particular Gaza, which was has been under siege since 2005. So there was a sense of like just like breaking that stalemate that has been absolutely devastating to Palestinians. But probably the more direct plan was to seize Israelis, as hostages. I think that they were probably aiming for soldiers, but they weren't aware of the rave that was going on. But taking hostages in order to negotiate for prisoner release, because this is something that has happened, many times in the past, where if there's a soldier that's been captured or whatever, that they'll negotiate like one soldier for, 100 Palestinian prisoners. And there's now like 10,000 Palestinians in Israeli prisons, at least. So I think that that was, if one could imagine like what the sort of, people sitting around making a plan, I think that was the plan. I think that but no one can brush under the carpet the hideous atrocities that occurred. But one of the other things that's, I think, coming out now in the as time passes and investigations have gone on, was many of the 1,136 people who died inside of Israel on October 7th were actually killed by Israeli counter terror responses. So because Israel, I mean, the breach of the Gaza wall was a security debacle for Israel, and then the fact that there weren't even soldiers in the vicinity, because all the soldiers were up in the West Bank guarding settlers who were beating and terrorizing West Bank Palestinians. So they had to like rush down to, the area near Gaza and just like opening fire and just killing indiscriminately. So that was, I think, the cause of a number of Israeli deaths.
Now, Prof, you mentioned 67 as being a key date, and many would say that the way in which the horror of the Holocaust is mobilized has changed since then and become a more central part of the Israeli national narrative in a way that Ben Gurion and others would not have recognized. To the extent that this is of any interest, what do you think people like Ben Gurion would think of what's going on today, not in terms of this war right now, but West Bank illegal settlement and the attempt to kill off Palestinians over the last 50 years?
Well, let me focus first on the issue of the Holocaust. I mean, you're correct. Like in the immediate aftermath of World War II, in the very early years of as Israel was establishing itself, there was a kind, I mean, there was a sort of like pride in those Israeli Jews who were Sabras. That was like the sort of they promoting this idea that the ideal Israeli is native born and rough and tough and can plow the fields and shoot the Arabs and et cetera. And so there was not a lot of sort of commemoration of the Holocaust, because in a way it was like the fact that 6,000 Jews went to their death or were exterminated was something that there wasn't like sort of a line to use that. But it really changes after 1967, when Israel becomes, sort of occupies the West Bank and Gaza along with the Golan and the Sinai, was to kind of re like claiming the Holocaust as a sort of raison d'être, as a reason for Israel to live, like that it will never happen again. And that was, I think, true of both labor and, when Likud came to power in 1977 for the first time, it was something that, really had a kind of cross political party appeal, was that, Israel's not going to be negotiating, not going to be compromising on issues of like strategic depth, the land question, because of the fact that, Israel is all they have and they need to, prevent a future Holocaust. So in that sense, it's been very, it's become significant to the kind of Israeli national culture in a way that it wasn't in the early years. But it's almost, and one could find the same sort of rethinking of the Holocaust or adapting it to new national meanings has occurred in Germany, right? I mean, Germany has, especially in the last, since maybe the 1990s, I mean, it's always been sort of the case that Germany, to its credit, really kind of after World War II took the fact that that country, that, the government, the elected government of that country had done one of the, created one of the most horrific, humanitarian crises in the history of the world, because it was so, industrialized, that, sort of taking, responsibility for that and accountability for that and making it an issue. But it's become in recent years, maybe the last 2 decades, where is Germany's sense of culpability for the Holocaust means that its support for Israel, sort of do or die, right or wrong, is bulletproof. And so, Germany is very much operating in a similar fashion to kind of the Israeli, what they call Hasbara, Israeli nationalist propaganda, which is that any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. And so, because Germany is, sees itself as a guardian against anti-Semitism because of its own, horrific history, it's really, waging this kind of cancel culture approach, if you want to use that term, to any criticism of Israel, and really like repressing, free speech in Germany of all kinds, punishing academics, sort of targeting anybody who's Muslim, et cetera. But also, I mean, this is not a Muslim issue. Critiques of Israel, extend across many, many sectors. So you see that kind of, sort of a very arm in arm kind of approach to, operationalizing the memory of the Holocaust to make it difficult, or subjecting people to, kind of the worst criticism of being an anti-Semite, because anti-Semitism is horrible. But sort of conflating criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism and then linking anti-Semitism to the Holocaust, it's like those, which of course are our linkages, but to try and use them with the broad brush that they're used now has a chilling effect on people, I think.
And just a quick thing, Prof. I think you misspoke and said 6,000 Jews died in the
6 million,
Holocaust.
I'm sorry. Six
Yeah.
million. Yes, okay, thank you.
It's
Yeah.
okay. And I think
6 million
earlier,
Jews plus other many other peoples,
plus,
Roma,
communists,
homosexuals,
queer people, many Slavic folks who were all kinds of religions, black people, you name it. Also, I think earlier you said that the US was arming Gaza's army, and I think you meant the Israeli army, probably.
Oh, arming, oh, sending arms to Israel and Gaza. Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay,
Yes.
right.
So sorry, it's just because these things are very sensitive,
Yes,
and
absolutely.
because I don't edit, I thought I'd jump in.
Oh,
Plus,
no, but the one thing I was sort of saying was that, they're sending arms to Israel, but even these, now this, airdropping of food is actually functioning like bombs because, Palestinians have been killed when the pallets, when the parachutes fail, so I think at least 5 Palestinians have been killed by American food bombs, so.
I mean, the other thing is, I don't want to miss a chance to mansplain, of course, and interrupt you and correct
Well,
you.
thank you. No,
Yes,
I'm always stand to be corrected. That's good.
absolutely crucial. But I didn't know about that, and that is in itself a terrible tragedy. So, Prof, I wanted to move slightly in another direction, but related to this in certain ways, namely to Guantanamo Bay, where you have made many field trips and lots of human rights investigation. And because the plurality of listeners is in the US, but by far from the majority, and there, because I have surveillance technology on my side, there are people all over the world. Could you tell us a little bit about what Guantanamo Bay is as a place in general, and what it became after 2001, and what your work there has been?
Well, so Guantanamo is a U.S. naval base on the south side of Cuba, and it was the United States, kind of kept it when it was fighting, on the side of Cubans to get rid of the Spanish colonial power. And so since 1904, the base, there's been a lease, the United States has leased the base, and the lease agreement basically says that the only way the lease agreement could be terminated is at the agreement of both countries. So since 1959, when when the old regime was overthrown and Castro came to power, that the Castro regime was trying for decades and still is, trying to get the lease canceled to get the United States out of that, area. But of course, the United States won't cancel the base. But the reason Guantanamo was selected after 9/11 to be used, and what it became and what it still is, was a long-term detention and interrogation facility. So the logic that under sort of inspired that choice was, it was done by sort of the reasoning was crafted by government lawyers in the Bush administration, and they wanted a place where they could hold captured people, where they could be, sort of in a sense outside of the reach of US laws and courts and lawyers. And so Guantanamo was select because was sort of optimal because it's not sovereign Israel, US territory, but it's close, geographically close to the United States, and it was far from the hot war zones of Afghanistan. So that was why Guantanamo was picked. The original idea was that people could just be held there, and whatever the United States, interrogators or guards would do to them, nobody would know, because it was secret detention. And this was the first time in US history that the government instituted a policy of secret detention. It was also the first time in US history that the government instituted a policy of torture, although the United States, of course, has a long history of torture, but it was never official policy until the War on Terror. And so the first detainees were airlifted in on January 11th, 2002, and they were, being held in secret detention. So long before I ever started going to Guantanamo, because my work is on torture and, like sort of war. That's how I had gotten interested in Israel and Palestine originally, was on my work on the Israeli military courts in the West Bank and Gaza. So after 9/11, and especially once Guantanamo was selected, I just started doing research. But it was really what was striking to me, and I mean, so my research was sort of like ongoing, and the main category of actors who were really doing things were lawyers. So the first charge in what I call the war in court, the first battle, was waged by the Center for Constitutional Rights, along with like these two death penalty lawyers, Joe Margulis and Clive Stafford Smith, who is British. And they challenged the president's right to secretly detain people at Guantanamo. But until they actually won in the Supreme Court in 2004, there were, the people were who were detained there. There was 780, total people were held at Guantanamo. Nobody knew what was happening to them because it was secret. And so, then lawyers, started going to Guantanamo because they had won that, sort of the detainees had won the right to have lawyers and to challenge their detention. And so then I started interviewing lawyers who were going to Guantanamo, but it was so frustrating, especially once that, the Bush administration started putting people on trial, because by then we knew that the US government had implemented a torture policy. We knew that everybody at Guantanamo had been tortured. And so I was very curious to learn how that fact was factoring into, efforts to prosecute people in these new fangled military commissions that the Bush administration had created. But it's, because like I couldn't go to Guantanamo as a citizen. I couldn't go to Guantanamo as a sociologist. And so finally, years on, me like interviewing lawyers and sort of gazing at Guantanamo through the lens of the New York Times or whatever, reading the tweets of journalists who were down there in 2010 when Obama was president. And the first person that the Obama administration put on trial was a Canadian who had been captured in Afghanistan when he was 15 and brought to Guantanamo when he was 16. And this was the first detainee that the Obama administration prosecuted. It was the first child soldier that any government in the world had prosecuted since World War II. So I was, and everybody knew that, Omar Khadr had been badly tortured, et cetera, and that he was being charged for a made-up war crime. He was charged with murder in violation of the laws of war because he allegedly, during a battle, threw a grenade that killed a US soldier. So first of all, it's like killing soldiers in battle is not a war crime. Like that's the whole point of battles, is to kill soldiers. But it was the fact that Omar Khadr was not himself a soldier that was used to kind of rewrite the laws of war. But anyway, I wanted to go there and see for myself. I mean, I wished I could go there and see for myself what was going on in the Omar Khadr case. And I was having lunch one day I was in New York City. I was having lunch in June, and the hearings were about to resume in July. I was talking with a psychiatrist who was a expert witness for the defense. I mean, she'd basically been, working with Omar Khadr because he had severe PTSD. And she was telling me what was going on down there. I was like, oh, I wish I could go. And she said, well, you could go if you're a journalist. And it was just like almost one of those cartoon moments where like this little light bulb like goes off in my head. I'm like, I write journalistically. Could I be a journalist? And so I got the publication that I'm most close to, which is Middle East Report. I got them to, sort of say that I was going to Guantanamo. I mean, Middle East Report is entirely volunteer labor. It's been around since 1971. But the editor like wrote to the Pentagon, like, dear Pentagon, please allow our legal correspondent, Lisa Hajar, and so I got to give it to the Pentagon. The one thing that they, aren't miserly about is they let anybody go to Guantanamo who can plausibly present themselves as a journalist. So my first trip to Guantanamo was in July of 2010, and I've been back there 14 times, and I'm planning on going back for 2 weeks in last week of April, first week of May. So a lot of the things that I've done or observed or been to Guantanamo for, especially since 2013, is mainly to go and report on and observe the military commission case in the military commission trial in the 9/11 case. So all of the defendants are, there are 14 people at Guantanamo who were held in long-term detention by the CIA and tortured by the CIA rather than the military. And so that case has been in pre-trial hearings since 2013. So it's 11 years. And like they're not anywhere near a trial because all the defense teams of the defendants are fighting for access to information about what the government did to their clients in the years between their capture and their transport to Guantanamo. And the prosecution, which is basically carrying water for the CIA, is insisting that those are the most tightly held, top secret matters in the United States. And therefore, the lawyers can't have access to that because it will damage national security. So it's just been this slow motion battle over, how torture matters, what a trial is going to look like. And so, one of the reasons why like I keep going to Guantanamo and very few journalists go is because there's nothing for a regular journalist that has to like pump out, I mean, Carol Rosenberg being the exception. She's with the New York Times and she's amazing. But it's not like these breaking stories like, oh, the 100 detainees are on hunger strike, or oh, whatever. It's now it's just these like motion battles over motions in the courts. But to me it's completely fascinating, and that's like one thing where I'd say like, my book, which I just published last year, called The War in Court, and even my continued interest is because I think, as a sociologist I can actually observe these kind of things and then try and make them comprehensible and even interesting to, general readers. So that's one of my goals. So, but I guess I will be going back to Guantanamo at the end of next month.
And whom do you speak to when you're there, Prof H?
I mean, we hang, whatever other journalists are there, they kind of keep us together. We've got our like public affairs minders, but also the lawyers. I mean, I've become like quite good friends with all the defense lawyers. The prosecutors are not interested in talking to journalists, but so there's opportunities to interview and talk to the lawyers. So over the years, it's kind of like the lawyers will come over to the media center, multiple times in any week and just give us updates or give us their take on what's going on. And so it's and I gotta say, like, I mean, although now I mean, I do function as a journalist, so therefore I guess I'm a jur I'm like I can wear the journalist hat. But over the years, like seeing like, sort of people who really whose primary job is being a journalist, like I have so much admiration for the ones like Carol Rosenberg and others who just, the kind of the work ethic, the ability to like just see and make sense of things that might be missed by, other folks, and then, bring that word out to the people, because journalists are the eyes of the world, for Guantanamo. So I've just had immense respect for like the good journalists who cover, that and other wars. Sort of war journalism is quite an occupation.
And Prof, two recollections from years ago. One is that Barack Hussein Obama II, during his 2008 campaign, claimed he would close Guantanamo Bay jail. The other is that the US military kept saying, we don't like torture, because if word gets out that that's what we do, then that'll be done to our people. Are those recollections batty on my part? Are they crazy? Are they right?
No, not at all. I mean, in fact, some of the strongest pushback against the executive branch's authorization of torture came from military lawyers, JAGs, Judge Advocates General, for exactly that reason. Like, they were trained not to torture. They were trained to regard torture, to understand torture as a war crime, and that if in the future, if the top lawyers didn't, push back against it, soldiers could potentially be court-martialed. So, I mean, their primary interest was in the health and well-being of the military. But like, Obama, absolutely was, sort of campaigned on his criticism of the Bush administration's, detainee policies, and I think he probably sincerely wanted it to close Guantanamo. Frankly, George W. Bush wanted to close Guantanamo by the time he left office. But it was because of, racism in the United States and this kind of like right-wing backlash against Obama, that the this surge led by Dick Cheney, like after he was out of office, this surge that everything the Bush administration had done was great, and that anybody who wanted to end torture, close Guantanamo, et cetera, was soft on terror. And one thing I will say about Obama is like, he is not does not have a very stiff backbone when it comes to standing up to criticism. And he surrounded himself by these really, horrible people. Like, Rahm Emanuel was his White House chief of staff, and he brought, John Brennan in from the CIA to be his White House counterterrorism advisor, and he kept oh, what's his name? Robert Gates, as who was Bush's last Secretary of Defense. Obama kept him, and Gates was adamantly opposed to closing Guantanamo. And so, the confluence of circumstances, the White House just didn't want to get roasted, every day on Fox News and by Mitch McConnell and others. So I think that they just kind of played ball. So Guantanamo is really, while it was established by a Republican administration, it is now fully owned as a bipartisan debacle in US history, the history we're still in.
On that issue of torture, about which you've written compellingly and movingly, one other argument that I recall from the first years after Guantanamo was used for this purpose was that it doesn't work. It doesn't provide reliable, actionable information, quite apart from the fact that it's inhumane and cruel.
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the truisms of, all times. Like, if just to take it, sort of unpack it, so torture is absolutely illegal. No one has a right to torture. Everyone has a right not to be tortured. But if you're even just thinking about it as a, putting it on the table as an option, it's a terrible option, because if interrogators don't know the answer or can't even judge, the veracity of what somebody is saying, by torturing them, people will say whatever, they think will stop the pain. I mean, that's indeed the story of the US torture program. It produced nothing in the way of actionable intelligence. It was like just a pure, unadulterated disaster. But the reason why, it was selected, or it was, argued, as necessary by Cheney and others, was because they have absolutely no knowledge of interrogation. They are purely ignorant of these very things that they were making policy of, and they were cutting out, anybody who actually does have expertise on these issues. They're hostile to international law, ignorant of, interrogation, ignorant of the military. I mean, Cheney never served in the military, so it didn't dawn on him that, U.S. soldiers are bound by the Geneva Conventions because they're incorporated into the Uniform Code of Military Justice. These non-military idiots that were, in Cheney's, inner circle, none of whom had, any military knowledge, were basically thinking, thinking like, well, the pre if the president says the Geneva Conventions don't apply, let's just say that the Geneva Conventions don't apply. So many things that happened were done out of sheer ignorance and hubris. I mean, that's literally, and you know, I mean, I would say that the fact that Guantanamo is still open is like that ignorance and hubris has just, you know, solidified into a permanent feature of, you know, the national landscape.
Dick Cheney, who famously, when asked why he had not served in Vietnam, proffered, "I had other priorities at the time."
You're like Donald Trump is out there trying to keep himself safe from syphilis or whatever.
I've
You know.
forgotten that one. Yeah, I think he may have done a few things that would have compromised that safety, but anyway.
Yeah.
So, in terms of human rights, Prof, I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about where human rights factor into your work, because you've shown a commitment to those issues with reference to Israel, with reference to Guantanamo Bay, with reference to torture. And yet, human rights often get a bad press as being too individualistic, drawn from nothing more than the sort of fictionalized war, law of the Nuremberg trials. And from the discourse of the global north.
So I mean, for example, like as a sociologist, you know, I'm just teaching a course, you know, this my sociology of human rights is like I offer students the ability to understand what human rights are designed to do, what they what all the critiques, as you just mentioned, that you know they don't resonate deeply in you know places where including in the United States, for example, where other kinds of identities or communal relations are you know stronger than this notion of the universal humanity of you know the universal individualism of human beings and so on. So we can think about it in you know both like in just as a kind of as a language as a terrain, but my particular interest has always been in sort of the relationship between law and violence. So the human rights that I tend to focus on are like what they call the harder human rights, like the right not to be genocidally exterminated, the right not to be tortured, the right not to be ethnically cleansed, the right not to be, you know, having bombs falling on, you know, deliberately targeting civilians. And so what became really exciting to me, you know, and why it's an ongoing interest is in the 1990s. I mean, partially tied to, you know, possibilities that were enabled by the end of the Cold War, but also by like horrific violence in this immediate post-Cold War, the genocide in Rwanda and the, you know, the horrors that were perpetrated in the former Yugoslavia, that international law started getting sort of developed in ways, you know, international criminal law. So in order to be able to hold individuals or striving to hold individuals to account who violated international law and perpetrated like those harder human rights. So, you know, and of course my favorite of all is the Pinochet precedent. You know, I always like tell anytime I get the chance to talk about universal jurisdiction, because that was the basis upon which Pinochet could be arrested on the basis of a Spanish warrant when he was in London. I always say, like, universal jurisdiction, it's the best jurisdiction. You know, love universal jurisdiction.
I find that many critics of universalism find it hard to accept that actually cultures and religions are all about universalism. That's their take. That's their point. So, Prof. Lisa, I'd like to ask one more question, if I may, and then throw to you to conclude matters by saying anything that we haven't yet covered or that you'd like us to address. So, my last question is, we know you go to the hut. Sorry, media center at Guantanamo Bay. And you talk to other journalists, who, by the way, are also sociologists, though they may not recognize that always, at least ethnographers, and I hope political economists. And you talk to lawyers, and that's part of how you find stuff out, both for your assignments and for your wider research. But in more general terms, how do you find shit out, Prof?
That's a good question. You know, I mean, like I'm an ethnographer. So, I mean, that's even the way I would describe, you know, my journalistic work. But, you know, so putting myself in places that I'm interested in and talking to whomever. So, you know, my first major research project, which became my first book, which was on the Israeli military courts in the West Bank and Gaza. And I spent 2 years and then went back, you know, over years many times. Like, so hanging out in the courts, interviewing the judges, the prosecutors, the defense lawyers, even people who'd formerly, you know, people once Palestinians, once they were out of prison, I could talk about their experiences. And then also just, you know, the kind of incredible work that investigative journal, like I rely on the work of investigative journalists and rigorous, you know, analysis and research by human rights organizations. So, you know, I would say that, you know, I mean, I certainly can find out things because I put myself in places and talk to people that, you know, have, you know, where things are going on or that they know things I want. But probably my better skill, the skill that I'm more, you know, like I would say that's my real gift, if one can call it a gift, is to be able to analyze these kinds of things. So even like, for example, in Guantanamo, like a lot of the journalists, including Carol Rosenberg, I mean, although because she's been there, I mean, she's been there like thousands of times. Like she is there all the time since 2002. Anytime a journalist is on Guantanamo, Carol Rosenberg is one of them. But, you know, the way that especially newspaper journalists write and think is very much like on an incremental, like what's the story today? Like when you've been there that long, you can start building up bigger stories. But you know, when I started going to Guantanamo, because I was really bringing in this kind of knowledge about torture and military courts and so on, I was seeing things in a different kind of way. And some journalists, you know, ones who didn't keep on going, they were just down there, would just sort of get, you know, annoyed because I wasn't focused on like the immediate thing that was happening that day, which was what their story had to be about, which is like, what did the, you know, the head prosecutor say? Or what was the one event that happened there? And so it was really, you know, and that's how even my writing, like all the journalistic writing I've did over the years about my trips to Guantanamo are much more like, let's put this place in context. Let's think about what the stakes are. Let's try and figure out the institutional motivations or whatever it might be. So trying to do that kind of sort of analysis. So I'd say that that's much more my skill set than, you know, breaking, you know, open some story that has never been told before.
Beautifully put. And Prof, I'm just rescuing a towel from the podcat.
Okay.
Darling, no. Chinguri, nom nomi chingeswe. Sorry, Prof. To conclude, I wonder if you might tell us whether there are things we haven't discussed so far today that you'd like to add.
Well, I think I would just say that if people who are listening find, you know, any of this stuff interesting, I would recommend my newest book, which is The War in Court, you know, Inside the Long Fight Against Torture. And that book is written in a journalistic style, like it's for a general audience, not a academic book. But you know, because we're, you know, like academics are constantly always looking for the next thing. Like I feel like I'm not done with, as long as Guantanamo exists, I'm going to keep on going. But one thing that I'm a project that I want to work on next when my chair duties allow is a book that I'm going to be calling Kidnapping Kissinger. So I've been obsessed with Kissinger since I was 7 years old. And but the book is actually going to be about this trial that occurred in 1971 in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And in 1971 I was 10 in and I was in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I mean, I wasn't really aware of the trial, but it was a trial that Iqbal Ahmed and the Berrigan brothers and a couple of other anti-war Catholic folks were put on trial on the, you know, accused of having plotted to kidnap Kissinger. And it was sort of one of like J. Edgar Hoover's last, you know, efforts to kind of really get those anti-war people. And but the thing also about the trial that's so significant is that because they had picked Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, because Harrisburg, Pennsylvania was so reliably conservative and it wasn't very Catholic. You know, and I was like, you know, the government figured they could get it, you know, like a pool of jurors who were not going to identify with the Catholic priests and were not going to identify with the anti-war sentiments. And so for that reason, this radical sociologist like went to Harrisburg and was working with sort of in support of the defense teams, and they basically started interviewing all kinds of people in Harrisburg, focus group research on them in order to figure out who would be the best jurors. And so jury selection originates in the Harrisburg Seven trial. So it's like it's got all my things. It's got Kissinger, it's got Harrisburg, it's got anti-war stuff, and courts, so I feel like that'll be the next thing I'll be working on is kidnapping Kissinger.
What an amazing story. Well, Prof. Ajara, thank you so much for your time with us today. It's been lovely
Thank you.
catching up apart from anything else, and I learn something every time I read your work, and I certainly learned a lot today.
Well, I'm really privileged and honored to have been invited onto your show. So I look forward to listening to it. And I'm sorry about the sort of misstatements about the number,
Prof,
so
as I
but
said, any opportunity to correct people and to mansplain is welcome.
right. Well, it's really been great chatting with you.
Thank you, Sam.